Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderfield.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. It's spring break, but we know of more than a few students who are busy planning for an upcoming event. March for Our Lives is to happen across the country on Saturday. It's an outgrowth of the call for school safety following the mass shootings in a Florida high school.
Franny Brewer of the Big Island Invasive Species Council makes the case for the creation of a statewide authority to address a critical and growing problem.
And in this, the year of the Hawaiian, we pay homage to Prince Jonah Kuhio Kalaniʻole as we prepare to celebrate his holiday a week from today.
HBU President John Gutunda looks at the growing popularity of esports and at the ways HBU is jumping on the bandwagon.
It's Monday, March 19th. The conversation starts right after the news. Across the country, there are efforts to finalize plans to organize various marches and rallies planned for Saturday, March 24th. It's an outgrowth of the mass shooting at a Florida high school. Here in Hawaii, students from both public and private schools are tweaking plans for a rally scheduled for Ala Moana Beach Park. Organizers Hayden Hawkins and Imiloa Borland sat down with us to talk about what's being organized. Hawkins attends University Laboratory School and Borland is from Punahou. They met through a group called Seeds of Peace, and they got to talking about how to get involved, and they ran with the idea after hearing about the mass shooting that killed 17 people.
The 24th is going to be a rally not just for high school students, but for everyone in the community to come together and support us in expressing our voices and our opinions. And it's very important that we get all the schools on the island to come together, because no matter if you go to private school or public school, this is an issue that still impacts all of us. No one is safe. If someone is determined to hurt you, no matter who you are, you know, like they can, you know, you're not immune from this, and we're all affected. And so it's important that all of us come together to fight this fight, because it affects all. It affects everyone in this country who goes to school and those who don't go to school. You know, we've had shootings that aren't just in schools, but shootings inside of a school are unacceptable, because that is a place for learning and for growth and for safety. And the fact that it's so easy to just take that all away is unacceptable.
I think I was in the middle of just one of my core classes, something. And I looked down at my phone and I had like a CNN alert just about a school shooting. And I was like, oh, okay, that's highly unfortunate. And I didn't really read about it. Later that day, I went home and like I read what happened as like details were still developing. And it was the same feeling I felt before, like after Orlando and after Vegas and after just like the other, just all the shootings we've had in the past couple years that I really remember. And I just thought, and I figured nothing might come out of this, whatever, and I just started to move on. But then one of the things that really brought me to take action this time is that there were speeches that were given by the students of Stoneman Douglas. There was rallies that were held in the days following the tragedy at their school. People like Emma Gonzalez speaking so passionately about problems that they've probably never really had like a major stage to speak about before. And I'll admit, like, the Emma Gonzalez speech brought me to tears. It's not like I don't cry. I cry, but I don't usually cry because of something I see on the news. Just maybe that's just the way I am, but that brought me to tears. And that truly is one of the reasons that I'm here doing this, because those students wanted to take action more than I think any other group in the history of this country. And if there's going to be major federal inaction, I'm going to step up to do what I can to bring federal action.
So what's planned for that day?
The 24th? We have a rally planned at Ala Moana Beach Park by McCoy Pavilion from 9 to 11 a.m. And we're planning on having like high school student speakers from as many schools as we can possibly get, speaking about this issue and what it means to us from a viewpoint from a state that doesn't really have violence like we often see in the mainland. And that can be a credit, like attributed to the gun control laws that we have here. Like, you could statistically show that. I must clarify, this is not a movement based on just raw emotion or feeling. That's part of it. But we also have like facts behind the things that we're saying. We have like data that shows that better gun control, like logical gun control laws, do save lives. And we want to push for that on a federal level. We want there to be like a higher minimum age to purchase like a firearm. Like, we're not in favor of things like bump stocks, clearly, and we want to make that heard. And the 24th rally is about highlighting those opinions from our state's youth.
And so what are you asking schools to do?
On the 24th, we don't have any specific requests to schools. We're trying to reach out to students that are willing to speak and come out to this event and express their opinion. and just talk about this issue. And it's open to families. It's a family event. It's at a family location, Ala Moana. And we want people to come out and reflect, in a way, have a good time and just have an important discussion about the issues that this nation faces.
So basically, you're going to have an open mic.
Yeah. In a way, we have speakers lined up, but we also want to, I believe we're going to try to open that up to members of the community, youth specifically.
Have you reached out to the kids in Florida at all in any way?
I personally have not. I actually plan to at some point, but I have not yet.
Yeah, and I just don't know, you know, if there's like a Facebook page that somebody set up, or, you know, if folks are communicating with them, you know, as a result of what happened over there.
Yeah. Well, there's no, like, communication between, like, I suppose, a centralized group or anything like that. We're kind of just on our own organizing
right.
this. So.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm sure they would probably be touched, the fact that, you know,
yeah.
here across the country, you folks are doing something here and to help support the cause.
Yeah, like a world away. It's kind of amazing. Sometimes I'm amazed. We're like, this is still the U.S. technically. But, like, legally, it's interesting. But, yeah, we're going to show our support from all the way out here in any way we can.
So. And so tell us what you had to do to plan for this event.
There's clearly things with renting equipment, like sound equipment, things like that, where the permit was one thing, but we got that permit. Just basic logistics too, flyer design, how are we going to share this, who are we going to contact, who's going to speak. There's a lot of things that went into like planning this. There's a lot of things that are still going into planning this. And we're just trying to get the word out there at this point. That's one thing. And we encourage everyone who wants to come out to support the cause to come out. That's, yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if maybe there are, like, a sponsor or somebody who can help you with some of the logistics. I don't know how you folks are paying for, like, the sound system, or is it all volunteer?
There's a lot of volunteering, yeah, like myself, other students, and, like, some parents. And actually, there has been a couple donations from, like, members of the community, which is amazing, honestly. And, like, we have, through Seeds of Peace and, like, other groups and, like, myself, like, we're putting money forward to try to, like, cover basic things. But beyond that, no, there's not, like, an official sponsor. This is just, like, a student-led event.
And Seeds of Peace, you were able to meet other students through this group.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Seeds of Peace is a cool group because they promote peace and, like, ways to go about that, like, conflict resolution, things like that. In a nutshell. And, like, I met Emi Loa through that program and other students that I've tried to reach out to, I've met through there. And they've been a very good resource for, like, sharing out information and, like, giving us advice, things like that, along, like, a couple other adults. Like, they've been wonderful, so.
I saw some things on social media where folks were targeting the kids that actually spoke out. How
yeah.
did you feel about that when you saw that?
I think that's a good example of the way that a lot of people in America are misinformed about a lot of things. And I don't know if that's a problem with fake news or something, or like not really doing research, but I can tell you now, I am not getting paid by anybody to do this. Like, I gain nothing. I'm not a politician. My family, there's no politicians in my family, nor my friends. I'm doing this because I care about an issue and want to inspire some form of change. And I'm not getting paid.
That was Hayden Hawkins and Emi Loa Borland, just two of the organizers of the March for Our Lives event at Ala Moana Beach Park. So far, students from about a dozen schools are expected to participate in that community event, again, that runs from 9 to noon on Saturday, March 24th. It will include a march along Ala Moana Boulevard as they rally for safer schools.
Hi, I'm Buffy Cushman-Pates from SEEKS, the School for Examining Essential Questions of Sustainability. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, creating a statewide authority to deal with invasive species. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa. kaua. O ahu, o molokai, o lanai, o mau, o kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
It's Hats Off to Women this month as we honor their place in history. And today we give a nod to a Hawaii woman whose fight for equality became her legacy. Many people may know that Representative Patsy Meek was the mother of Title IX. It's a federal law covering gender equity in education and in athletic programs. It was signed into law in 1972, and Meek's story is important. She was rejected from a number of medical schools in the 1940s because she was a woman. Her daughter, Wendy, apparently suffered similar treatment. At age 7, she was discouraged by a teacher from running for president. Leave that for the boys. She was told to run for vice president instead. Her mother, Patsy Meek, did go on to study law at a university in the Midwest. She was said to be one of only two women accepted into that program. We're looking for the name of that university that said yes and changed Patsy Meek's destiny. You can call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Decades after Title IX was enacted, there is still not the parity some might expect. Athletic facilities are still an issue. Most recently, our partners at Civil Beat reported on how here in Hawaii, locker facilities for girls were lacking compared to those for boys. The ACLU has pressed the issue with the Department of Education. There are measures advancing legislation this session that the Women's Caucus is behind. We spoke with Senator Laura Thielen about some of those efforts.
We have a Title IX, because I don't know if you're aware, the DOE is not in compliance with Title IX. Betsy DeVos pulled back on some stuff, so we have a combination bill that puts the guidance that came out under Obama into state law, because we don't have Title IX in state law, which I was surprised to find out, and then a concurrent resolution to call the DOE to the table so we can follow up.
That was Senator Laura Thielen talking about efforts to advance gender equity in our schools in a nod to the legacy of Congresswoman Patsy Meek as we mark Women's History Month. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month, and if you haven't checked your colon and you're over 50, it's time to get it done. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with a cancer expert about the reasons to check early and how that can make all the difference. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Invasive species have been corrupting Hawaii's environment since the first human contact, but recent generations have seen new invasives arriving at an ever-increasing rate. To date, there has been no single statewide agency to deal with the problem, which is why Senate Bill 2399, which would create a Hawaii Invasive Species Authority, is currently being considered. Earlier today, I asked Franny Brewer, Communications Director for the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, if the problem had reached critical mass.
I'm sitting here on the Big Island, surrounded by fire ants and albizia and coffee berry borer and all kinds of things that are affecting our daily lives here. So I would say the answer to that question is yes from my end.
Are new invasive species introductions still happening?
Oh, absolutely. And with the increase in traffic, more goods coming into Hawaii, there's actually a higher risk now. So they estimate that there's about one new organism on average a day that makes it to Hawaii's ports. And just in insects alone, about 20 new insects are being accidentally established every year.
How?
Well, we ship in a lot of stuff. So lots of things are coming into our ports, and we don't have enough inspectors, and we don't have enough inspection facilities. So that's one of the big problems. There's sort of some gaps in coordination between the various agencies that are responsible for tracking invasive species. So without having the right kinds of communication software and technology, like e-manifest and that sort of stuff, it's really difficult for us to know where these things, if they're coming from the most critical pathways, right? So that's one of the things that you really want to focus on is looking at your high-risk pathways of things that are coming into the islands, and we don't have great capability at that. So one of the things that's proposed in the new biosecurity plan is that we're going to make major improvements to analyzing those pathways and really prioritizing the things that get inspected, because it's just impossible to inspect the tons and tons and tons of goods that come into Hawaii every day.
Franny, you just said something about having different organizations not having the same software. Are you painting a picture of different organizations that are kind of working on the same thing without adequate coordination of their efforts?
Yeah, that's right. So we have Hawaii Department of Transportation, Hawaii Department of Health, Hawaii Department of Agriculture, Department of Land and Natural Resources. You have aquatic resources. You have land resources. So you have all these various departments that need to coordinate on invasive species. But we don't really have a great process for integrating that. And that's one of the reasons that the Hawaii Invasive Species Authority has been proposed, to really help bring that communication and that integration together so that the departments are working in coordinated fashion.
I would have thought, I suspect a lot of people in Hawaii would have thought that this already had been in existence for some time. Certainly the problem's been in existence for some time.
Sure. And, you know, it's very challenging to bring all these people together. We do have a great example of us beginning to really get a handle on that with the Mamalo Poi Poi program, which is a program at the Department of Transportation. But it's working with the Department of Agriculture, working with the ISCS, working with a Hawaii Ant Lab to actually do inspections and trapping at the various airports to very actively be looking for some really high priority pests that we're concerned might be coming in.
Well, Franny, given given resources to do everything you want to do, how would you deploy resources? What would you do if you were suddenly given a blank check?
I'm not in charge of that. there's a lot of different areas, right? So the way that biosecurity is looked at, there's pre-border, there's at the border, and then there's post-border. So there's, you know, the prevention, the things that might be coming in, and looking at the things that are coming in and what are the best ways to screen and keep things out and really have strict controls over what's coming into the island. So that's one area that's really important. And prevention is something that has the least cost in the long run, right? Like preventing something from coming in is going to be the cheapest way to control an invasive species. And then you have what's going on at the border. So you have your inspections, things that are, you have early detection, like we're doing with Mamalo Poi Poi, where we're at the airports, we're doing active traps to look for insects, to look for Africanized bees, things that we're afraid might be coming in. So we're doing these early detection efforts that if it does come in, we find it early so we can get rid of it. And then you have post-border, once things have kind of gotten here and gotten established, are we finding them early enough? Are we responding to them early enough? And so that's one of the proposals that's in the biosecurity plan, and it's going through the legislature right now, is, for instance, an early detection fund, a rapid response fund. We do not currently have a pot of money to draw upon if a new invasive comes in to quickly mobilize a team and go after that invasive species. And so sometimes these delays, while you're trying to secure funding, you're trying to establish, you know, what the next steps are going to be, who's going to be responsible, a delay like that, a year or two, can really allow an invasive species to spread. And so we want to make sure to get these mechanisms put into the legislature, put through the legislature, so that we can have that ability to react quickly and be very nimble when we're responding to an invasive species.
Well, Franny, what you described, those three stages you described, prevention at the point of arrival, and then once an invasive has been established, it gets more expensive with each step, doesn't it? Way more.
Absolutely.
Expensive.
Yeah, significantly so. The longer something is here, and we're finding that out on the Big Island, for instance, with little fire ants. So that's something that is costing people money every day now to live in, you know, most of the east side around Hilo or in Puna. You know, it becomes something that you have to do regularly. You have to have either yourself or you pay someone to treat your property for little fire ants or else it's unlivable.
How long has that been going on?
Well, little fire ant was first detected here in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that, you know, by the time we really were able to respond to it, the Department of Ag was able to respond to it. The legislature established the Hawaii Ant Lab. So that was a great step. They came up with the tools that were needed. But by the time we had even found the ant, it was already so widespread that they were unable to eradicate it. That happened really quickly because people were not looking for it. They weren't paying attention, and it sort of spread very quietly and quickly through a very large area. That's an example of one of the biggest pathways that we have right now of things coming in through the nursery industry, the horticultural industry, importing plants. That's how we got coqui frog. That's how we got the ant. That's how we got the semi-slug. You know, live plant material coming into Hawaii has been identified as one of the top pathways for future pests and diseases. So it's not something I'm even looking at saying, oh, well, this is how things came in the past. This was a 2015 report done by the Forest Service that was saying, okay, where are the next big pests and diseases going to come from? And they identified in live plant material as being the number one pathway. So that's something we have great concern. We've already seen it happen with some major pests. And we're afraid we're going to continue to see that happen if we don't get stricter controls.
Franny Brewer is a communications director for the Big Island Invasive Species Committee, which has offered testimony in support of Senate Bill 2399, a bill that would establish a Hawaii Invasive Species Authority. You can find links to the bill on our podcast page on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Ten years ago in this economy, Bear Stearns had failed and something bad was this way coming.
We were dealing with trying to put out a fire without the right tools to do so.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The analogy, while rough, is fairly apt. Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner in conversation next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 25 years of support for Hawaii Public Radio, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard was quick to respond to a national groundswell in favor of gun control by voting, along with a vast majority of her colleagues, on a bill to increase security at schools. That's in the wake of the Parkland High School shooting. Does her vote give us an accurate picture of her record on gun control measures? Dick Gruby has that story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, Nick.
Hey, Chris, how are you doing?
All right, you're in D.C. now, huh?
I am in Washington, so it's a little bit later here for me, about 6 hours.
Chance to get a close-up view of what's going on. And Congresswoman Gabbard has, you know, that recent vote was predictable. Very few voted against that recent bill for increased security at schools. Does that reflect her past voting record?
Well, you have to remember that if we're talking about gun control and guns, there aren't a lot of votes that actually are taken these days, and that's for any number of reasons. And mostly having to do with the fact that Republicans are in control of Congress and, of course, the White House right now.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do look at there have been a couple of votes that she has taken in recent years, and she sort of split with the majority of her Democratic colleagues in one case in which she was voting on a concealed carry law or a bill that would make it easier for people with concealed carry permits to cross state lines. with concealed weapons. She voted with the majority of Democratic colleagues, but then on another bill involving veterans' access to firearms, she sided with the majority of Republicans on that particular measure. In fact, Hawaii's other congresswoman, Colleen Hanabusa, in that case, voted against that particular measure, whereas Congresswoman Gabbard voted for it.
You always, with gun control votes or the absence of gun control votes, look at the issue of who's contributing to campaigns, because the NRA and its local affiliates are big campaign contributors, aren't they?
Well, I think when you look at the NRA and the Hawaii Rifle Association, they are politically powerful in different ways, mostly when we're talking about the NRA, the National Rifle Association, that don't always have to do with campaign contributions. I mean, they are highly organized, and they are able to mobilize their members to write letters to their representatives, as well as show up at rallies, et cetera. They have a very strong, cohesive voice. The Hawaii Rifle Association is a little bit different, of course, Hawaii being a heavily Democratic state, lots of Democrats in the states. It's not as powerful as a lobby as the National Rifle Association, and that's sort of reflected in their campaign contributions. I mean, you'll see a few thousand dollars here and there that they've given to local candidates. And in fact, Chad Blair and I did an analysis of this a few weeks ago, which is, of course, what sort of put us on the path of looking at Congresswoman Gabbard's record, because she had actually received some money from the Hawaii Rifle Association when she was running for city council.
Mm-hmm. Any indication of those, you know, a lot of campaign contributions land without much effect? Is there any indication that this has affected her?
Oh, I mean, we're talking about $400 in a campaign a long time ago.
Exactly.
She hasn't accepted money from the NRA or this particular group at the federal level, you know, ever since she's been here. And here in D.C., that is. And so, you know, it's hard to say, but I mean, when you do look at her record, it's kind of all over the place when it comes to sponsorships and co-sponsorships of particular legislation. She hasn't always signed on to bills that many of her colleagues in the Democratic Party have until it appears she has been criticized for sort of being absent from some of that legislation, namely like an assault weapons ban of 2015, which she never signed on to, and the assault weapons ban of 2018, which she signed on to recently after being criticized on social media about it.
Well, Nick, we're going to want to stay with this story. Thanks very much for checking in with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was reporter Nick Gruby with today's Reality Check from Honolulu Civil Beat. And to read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Next week, Monday, a week from today, we honor Prince Jonah Kuhio Kalaniʻiniʻole with the state holiday. He's credited with starting the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs, which in December marks its 100th anniversary. So we thought it fitting to talk about his legacy in this year of the Hawaiian. We sat down with Anil Amaral, who is the president of the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs. She reminds us that the clubs advocated for Hawaiian history in public schools, getting academic credentials in Hawaiian studies, and also advocated for the use of Hawaiian language.
He was born in the time when the Hawaiian nation lived, and then he was prince of the realm. He was to inherit the kingdom of Hawaii. However, what ends up happening is that in 1893, of course, the kingdom is overthrown by American businessmen who basically need Hawaii as a land base for business. Kuhio His name, Kalani Anaʻole, means the leader that is never satisfied. And I think when you look at what he has accomplished for all of us, the native people of Hawaii, you see that striving always to be better for his people. The thing you need to understand is that the legacy of the alii is to take care of their people. That's their responsibility, yes? And so we saw it in all of the trusts that are set up. Liliʻu, the last reigning monarch, of course, sets up the trust for orphan children. Queen Emma sets up this wonderful hospital for sailors and for Native Hawaiians. And, you know, Kapiʻolani sets up a hospital for women and children. Pauahi, the education of Native Hawaiian children. And so it goes. That's their responsibility. And when Kuhio comes in, and he's orphaned, so he is hanai by Queen Kapiʻolani and King Kalakaua, destined to become king himself. And Liliʻu then is overthrown. So he struggles with his identity. What is he to be now? And he joins what was called Naukuakoa, the Hawaiian Rural Party. And the intention of these Hawaiian men and leaders was to restore the kingdom. But he eventually, I think, becomes despondent over the lack of action, and he walks out of their convention. He instead becomes a member of the Republican Party. He runs for Congress. Overwhelmingly, he is elected into Congress, a non-voting delegate to Congress, and that provides him with the footprint to begin to change things for his people. He starts at the very core of it. Kuhio is worried about the rehabilitation of his people, and he knows that he must do something to preserve the culture. So he sets up the five societies, Royal Order, which continues the mystery of alii and leadership, right? Ahahui Kaʻahumanu, who continues, again, the legacy of one of the highest-ranking chiefess there ever was. So high is her rank that Kamehameha has to crawl on his belly to her. That's a pretty picture. Anyway, moving on. There's Haleona Alii, where all their meetings are conducted in Hawaiian, so you're able to preserve the language. Maʻamakakaua, the warriors, daughters and sons of Hawaiian warriors, who keep the knowledge of lua, of fighting, right? It was Kuhio that started those societies to protect the culture. But as he looks around, he knows, too, that he's got to bring his people. He's got to transition his people. And so he forms the first Hawaiian Civic Club that today we call the Hawaiian Civic Club of Honolulu. Back then, it was just called the Hawaiian Civic Club because there was no other, right? And he formed that in 1918, the intention of which was to challenge Hawaiians to advocate on civic matters, because this was a man who learned things were not going to change for us, and we had to learn about representational democracy, and we had to advocate with a Hawaiian voice for our people and for the good of our people. That's the amazing leadership of this man. Every time we celebrate Prince Kuhio Day, we look to see all those foundations he put in place. As a non-voting delegate to Congress, picture that, right? He passes one of the most substantial acts for Native Hawaiians. That's the Hawaiian Homes Rehabilitation Act that allows Hawaiians, and he used the model of the American Homestead Act. So it allows Hawaiians to get back on the land, to restore their identity and to restore their future. He's upset, of course, even though this passes, he's upset that the blood quantum is 50%, and he wanted it lower than that, but he was never able to change it. Until today, we can't change it. He was upset that the land was in trust rather than fee simple, because he wanted it in fee simple. So, you know, he didn't accomplish everything he wanted, but he provided us with a mechanism to have some of our foundation back. to save our language and to give us voice.
And as we approach the holiday this month, then we take time out to really pay homage and look at Department of Homelands and the civic clubs and the societies and remember how they started.
Yes, yes. And importantly, too, to challenge us always to remember that the burden of the leader is to keep pushing things forward, to never be satisfied, as this leader was never satisfied, and keep making our world a better place for our future.
So as the president of the civic clubs today, we'll be taking this year to kind of plan events out to mark the centennial.
That's true. The first celebration will actually happen in December because the Hawaiian Civic Club of Honolulu was chartered in December. And so there will be a huge gathering, I think December 9th, Ho'olauleʻa, at Iolani Palace. And what you'll see are, well, of course, tons of booths with crafts and always hula and always music. But you can go from booth to booth. We'll have a genealogy of our civic clubs. So you can walk along and see who were the first clubs and where were they placed and receive information on what these clubs do. And if you have an interest in participating, civic clubs are primarily Hawaiians. But non-Hawaiians are also allowed to join, invited to join if they have an interest.
Well, what do you think is going to be the biggest challenge in this year?
There are so many challenges. I actually was quite happy when I saw the bill in the legislature to create an authority for Mauna Kea. And separated, you know, from the Department of Land and Natural Resources and the University of Hawaii, and create a separate authority in which the preservation of the sacredness of that mountain and the identity of the mountain could start, you know, and we could start to add the features that we need to protect and preserve while still using astronomy and still teaching science.
And then where
did it die?
Where do the clubs fit in also with issues that are pertinent today with funding for Department of Homelands and spending at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs?
Yes, yes. We are advocates, okay? So sometimes we are going to hear things that we don't think we like, right? We are offended when we hear the head of the Department of Hawaiian Homes say we are not in the business of building housing. Perhaps she didn't read the name of her department well enough. So we make that voice heard. You are in the business of building housing for Native Hawaiians. You will see us. The way we do things, Catherine, is first of all, we're organized by clubs. That's direct membership. And the clubs are sort of area-based, land-based, right? Like we have Ahahui Sivila Hawaii o Kapolei. That's located in Kapolei, right? And clubs in Waianae and Makaha and like that. But then sometimes we're organized around Ali'i, Prince Kuhio Hawaiian Civic Club, Queen Lili'u Okalani Hawaiian Civic Club, Princess Ka'iolani. They're organized around the history of their Ali'i, and they do work and things around that. The clubs are also organized by counties. So we have councils where they bring the club presidents and the permanent member together to deliberate and to talk. And then there is the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs that brings all of the clubs from all the counties and from the continent, because we have clubs on the continent. So those leaders together in board meetings to deliberate. And once a year, we meet in convention from Tuesday to Sunday, and we deliberate over matters of importance.
So you're really kind of the conscience of the community.
We are the advocates of the community. Our community doesn't always agree with the positions we take, as you can imagine. But we have a reputation at the legislature because The matters we bring to their attention have been passed by the majority of delegates in convention in a process that is deliberative, representational, and by majority rules.
That was Anel Amaral talking about the Hawaiian Civic Clubs and Prince Jonah Kuhio Kalaniʻole, who we have to thank for the preservation of identity for Native Hawaiians. For a list of events planned for the Kuhio holiday, check out the Conversations webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org. For our backyard quiz, we remember the late Representative Patsy Mink and her efforts to get Title IX passed into law. It states, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." Those 47 words had far-reaching effects as women surpassed men in undergraduate degrees and allowed far more female athletes to compete and excel than ever before. Patsy Mink described being rejected from medical school as the most devastating disappointment in her life, but she would go on to graduate from law school, becoming the first Japanese-American woman to practice law in Hawaii and take her place in history as the first woman of color in Congress. We were looking for the name of the college that said yes to Patsy Mink and opened doors for her. That school was the University of Chicago.
And Catherine Melvin Lang of Kailua, a personal friend of the Minks, was the first to get that answer right. The second person to get a correct answer was from a sixth grader named Sophia James. Congratulations to both. And that's our quiz for today. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Athletics is changing, and someday soon, the major sporting events of the year may well be the kind that are played only in the virtual realm, so-called e-sports. Hawaii Pacific University has become an enthusiastic early adopter of e-sports. Last month, it opened the state's first e-sports arena at Aloha Tower Marketplace. We spoke to HPU President John Kotunda about his reasons for going all in.
Well, HPU wants to provide a real innovative and personalized experience for students, and so esports fit perfectly in with that. This mm-hmm. is, one of the most innovative new sort of sports, and I think that being one of the early adopters in this fits right in with the theme of what the experience also we're trying to provide for our students.
An initial reaction might be, these are kids who live in a world of virtual reality rather than reality. But there's more to it than that, is the way you're describing it.
Absolutely. And in fact, 65% of college-age students say that they play some form of video games. This is incredibly popular among sort of that generation. And there's a huge viewership for this. It's estimated that in 3 to 4 years, the viewership for esports will exceed that of all traditional sports. And in fact, the last League of Legends final, the viewership for that exceeded that of the NBA final game or the World Series final. And in fact, the viewership for the mid-season invitational for League of Legends was 360 million unique viewers, which is three times that of the Super Bowl. So this is incredibly popular, and it's becoming even more popular and more accepted. The International Olympic Committee is actually considering having esports be an Olympic sport in the 2024 Paris Olympics.
We always hear, with regard to college sports, traditional college sports, that the values that they instill, the values that they have beyond the playing field. Can the same be said for esports?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It creates and fosters teamwork, creativity, time management, use of and very good use of technology. But at the same time, the rules and their ethics and that one has to adhere to. And in fact, we have one of our professors that is studying in one of his classes esports and the rules and regulations and as part of the communications class.
Well, it certainly would call for. I'm trying to think of what skills it would call for. Mastery of a great deal of detail, for one thing, right?
Absolutely, and creativity. There's a lot of creativity and strategy that go into this. And, of course, the participants play in teams here. So they need to work closely together, and that, I think, also builds relationships among sort of the team members themselves.
What's an example of an e-sport? Forgive my ignorance. I'm trying to figure out what your team is trying to accomplish. You know, are you pushing toward the goal line, or what's the structure of a typical e-sport game?
Well, it depends on the game.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
So there could be a game like League of Legends where the object would be to – there are certain goals that the team – you know, will try to achieve, and to it's very similar to a battle strategy type game.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a game like NBA 2K, where it's more of what probably you and I were used to in the early sort of video games, which is incredibly advanced now. But NBA 2K, actually, 17 NBA teams have started a esports NBA 2K League that will kick off next year. So that's a wholly different type of game that is also played on a professional level now.
It really sounds as if we might be moving toward kind of non-physical athletics.
Well, I think it complements the physical athletics.
Yeah.
It's just a different type of sport.
You know,
if you define sport is really just defined as you know, physical activity where people come together to play in a competition. And yet, esports, it does involve physical activity. It just doesn't involve the same type, maybe, of physical activity, but it has the same, at times, characteristics like teamwork, like creativity, like time management that we often see in many sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I do think in the end, esports really is a type of sport, and it does have many of the same types of characteristics.
Well, certainly I would think that as a team effort, the whole emphasis on strategy, you know, I'm thinking back to some of the original games, things like chess, which were really practice for warfare in a sense, and how military strategy works, you know, knights and pawns and all that kind of thing. And that the basic structure of a game, moving your people forward to get territory from the other guy, doesn't seem to have changed that much.
No. And in fact, I was watching curling the other day on the Olympics, and I'm fascinated by it. I was watching it on TV, and then I was thinking, you know, esports to some extent involves a similar type of strategy and thinking and placement. And so in many ways, I think it is very similar to many of the types of sports that we see.
What does the adoption by HPU of esports say about your philosophy as a university?
Well, as a philosophy of the university, we do want to be innovative. We want to provide a very personalized experience for students. And I think the adoption of esports speaks directly to that. It is one of the most innovative sort of new endeavors. 300 of the universities across the country have already adopted esports, including schools in the Big Ten, in the Pac-12. Schools like UC Berkeley, Arizona State are very big, and UC Irvine in Utah are have esports programs. And so we want to be one of the early adopters in this and participate in this because we recognize where this is going. At the same time, as I said, we want to provide a very personalized experience for our students. So we want to bring them out of sort of the dorm rooms and bring them into a space where they can come together and have more of a community. And so we're providing an esports arena here, not only for our esports athletes to participate, but really for the whole community to come together, really to have fun and enjoy sort of the space and to build sort of relationships that for us we hope will last a lifetime for our students.
I'm thinking that if your esport team has a match coming up with the University of Michigan, they don't have to get on a bus or a plane to meet the other team, do they?
That's true. You can play with against teams all over the world. And that's one of the interesting sort of phenomenon about esports. In fact, you can create teams to where people are in different locations. But it is, I think, one of the very interesting new types of sports that is creating, I guess, too, sort of a redefining how we think about sport overall.
Even to the point where you folks are offering scholarships for adepts in.
That's right. That's right. And we're not the first to do this, but we are offering scholarships for qualified esports athletes who want to participate in the program. As well as we have a competitive team that will play against other universities in this. And we, again, have a esports arena that they practice in, that they can play in, and that we can host tournaments too in. In fact, yesterday we had a grand opening of our new esports arena, and we invited a number of high school teams to come and play. And I think it was St. Louis and Roosevelt. Their teams wound up in the finals, and it was broadcast actually over radio. So the viewership of that is I think there's a huge viewership, a huge interest, you know, in the local community too for this.
John Gotanda is the president of Hawaii Pacific University, and last month, HPAU held the grand opening of the state's first collegiate esports arena at Aloha Tower Marketplace. To learn more, you can visit the Conversations Facebook page.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we sit down for the whole hour with Honolulu's Police Chief, Susan Ballard. We invite you to call us with your questions and comments.
In the meantime, if you have any feedback about our programs, you can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HIConversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under talk shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vanderkook. Join us tomorrow for more of the Conversation.